Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Fuqua, I'm not sure who on your team should address these questions, but I know one of the issues that you've talked about tonight has been traffic, and certainly that's an important issue. But I think the other important issue that we're all concerned about is that of protection for the environment. So could you highlight those, what efforts you will be taking to protect the environment, whether it be buffers or I know you're talking about stormwater management, but I didn't see any stormwater management ponds on your, you know, the plans that you showed us. But Jeff, if we expand on that.
I'll be glad to. There are no ponds. The requirement here, as you may already know, when you have a direct tidal connection like this, is we need to manage water quality, not quantity, and ponds are typically associated with the quantity management. In this particular case, as Mr. Ryman stated, in the area of the site that's closest to Long Neck Road, the depths to the seasonal high water table is greatest. So in those areas, the plan is to use pervious pavements, and so that water will infiltrate into the site. As we start moving out to the north, that's no longer going to be applicable. In those cases, then we have filter strips, that the water from the street pavements and the campsites need to pass through them before they're discharged overboard into the canals or into the waterway that surrounds the property. As you already said, there is that 50-foot buffer all the way around. That yellow image that you see on all the exhibits is the identified 404 wetlands. That, of course, is a natural filter that's there. We're not including any of that in any of the campsites. As I stated in my testimony, and if you were able to actually get out there into these areas that are painted yellow on my exhibit, you would see that the wetlands, as they currently are not in great shape. It's been they've been run over with ATVs and hunters, and it's just not been maintained that well. The agencies, when we go to them for our permits for these waterborne activities like the piers and the boat launching facilities, they will require us to upgrade those, to reestablish the plantings out there, and to fix them. The other thing that will happen, I think, is one of the biggest environmental pluses here is that we need to stop the shoreline erosion problem that's occurring there. And there are several different conditions. We have, if you've been on the site, on the right-hand side of this site plan is what we all call Massey's Ditch. If you step off the site and walk out there 15 or 20 feet, the water's over your head. It's a very deep waterway. It's narrow. It's swift. So the erosion there is different than the erosion on the northern part of the site, which is primarily caused by boat wake action. So that's different. And the erosion inside the site is different, caused by other factors. So we've already met with the agencies, the Corps, the National Marine Fisheries, and all those folks who have to bless these water-dependent activities, and they will require us to upgrade the wetlands aspect of this project. So we have a wooded site now. Mr. Fawcett, Lynn's father, planted those trees himself many years ago. It might go without saying that a campground is certainly enhanced by keeping as many of those as we can. That's the intention. I think the fact that this particular land use is going to be an educational facility for the young campers, that collectively that group will continue to have an impact on this site that it doesn't currently have and may never have if this wasn't a land use here.
So how might you delineate those wetlands so that you don't have the continued degradation of those areas? Because, in fact, I'm hearing you saying that you're going to be improving the wetland areas.
That's correct. In fact, left like this is, what happens, and again, if you get out there on those areas that are yellow, you would see that the Phragmites plant has taken over. It's invasive, and it's not what's meant to grow there. So that has to be eradicated. That's a program that takes some time and then reestablished with the plantings that were there many years ago.
And what kind of services are we talking about in terms of the roadways, in terms of parking pads, in terms of the impervious surfaces?
Well, there is a pervious pavement. We can either use pervious asphalt or pervious concrete. That decision has not been made yet, but the pervious pavements will be used as the pads themselves. And on these larger drawings, you see those gray shapes that I have on the individual campsites. Those represent the actual camping pad itself. Obviously, every RV is not going to be that large, but those will be paved. The area where the automobiles are parked will be paved. We don't know what type of pavement that's going to be, other than it will be pervious, whether it's going to be asphalt or concrete. The rest of the individual campsites, as we've shown on the enlargement, will be turf. That needs to be, the Sussex Conservation District will require that we have that's stabilized with vegetation. And so, that will all be under their guidance.
So along the same questions with your strips that you were talking about, that they will be designed to filter out some of the pollutants that come from the RVs and the cars that are parked on those lots.
That's correct. And the preliminary meetings we've had with the Sussex Conservation District, they want us to drain everything toward the streets where it's managed then before it's discharged overboard again.
And in looking at the drawings that you submitted to us, it appears that about 10% of the units are going to be perhaps the, what do you call them, the park models?
Correct.
So those units would in fact remain there, and perhaps per county or requirements they'd be disconnected from the water and sewer.
Well, they have to be. They can be there in more than 180 days, and they have to have quick disconnect couplings. They need to have the wheels need to be on the carriage of the vehicle, and they need to be able to be removed in the event that there's a problem.
So is the intention of those units to be rented out seasonally, or what's the thoughts behind having so many park models?
Well, I think that there's a couple of thoughts. One is what we've been told, and Kathy might be a better individual to answer this since she's in the business, but what she's told us is that many campers have friends who don't have RVs. And so if you look in the site plan where these park models are set up, they're across the street from RV sites so that folks can camp, friends can camp, one that has an RV and one that doesn't, and they can enjoy that. The intention of this park is not to have seasonal sites. Is that the business plan is that these would be transient, and I would even go a step further to say that the state fire marshal has asked us to make that a condition of his approval, that they not, it makes a difference to him whether they are seasonal or transient. Mr. Fawcett has signed an agreement with the fire marshal that they will be transient in order to get the approvals that we need from the state fire marshal's office.
Because I know there's other parks in the area where they are basically set up as seasonal rentals for those units, and those are the ones that have all the additions and the buildings and the.
That is not the intent for Castaways at Massey's Landing.
Help me out with traffic. I mean, I'm having a real hard time coming up with these numbers as to how they, DLDOT is saying that we had, so many, with the previous project, the RPC, you were going to have so many units. And now we've increased the number of units, in terms of the increased numbers of units you'd have available for the RV park. How'd they come up with a 20% reduction in traffic?
Yeah, I think it's a traffic engineering question.
The single-family house generates about 10 trips a day. That's lots of studies that have been done that DLDOT references that we're required to use. Those numbers are dictated to us by DLDOT, so it's not something we choose or decide. So the original development was 130. The original TIS that was done, that they're referencing, was actually 130 residential units. The recorded plan's 120. So when the TIS was done, it's about 1,300 trips per day that was generated and studied in the TIS. Based on the RV park use, we are at 1,018 trips. So that's about a 20% reduction from the 1,300. So, and again, the determination for the trips is a scientific study that DLDOT references on every project that we are required to submit to them. So it's straight out of that. It's not anybody's opinion. It comes straight from the ITE manual, which is a manual that Deldot references. So that's the difference in the two numbers.
Well, I'm glad that you put it in more definitive terms than by my guessing, because for the record, I do own two RVs. I do travel extensively with those. I just came back from a 10-day camping trip. And the only time I left the campground was two times. That was the fly to a business meeting and back. Otherwise, my vehicles never did leave that campground.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
So I have no further questions at this point, Mr. Chairman.
All right, sir.
Mr. Burton. Okay. Some of my questions Mike asked, but let me go back to the park model thing. Those are to be permanent units, or they're to be, tell me again what they are.
A park model is a recreational vehicle. So they're by definition a recreational vehicle. They travel on the road with wheels. They have a square footage that has them qualify for that. And the only difference is that these ones that we've sprinkled around the site in different areas that we talked about earlier, those will stay there for 180 days, which is what the code allows for that type of vehicle in this setting. If we were to set them up, if we were to block them up above the flood zone and have them, you know, this high off the ground out there where we have them, they could stay there permanently. We're not going to do that. We're going to have them stay there 180 days and pull them. So they are, of all the units, of all the 322 units there, they will be there all season long. The residents in those units will not.
Okay, so the plan at the end of the season on October 31st would be that everybody else leaves and these just get disconnected and they would remain.
Well, they need to move. They need to move out of the flood zone in this particular case. And there is an exhibit. I don't have my book here, but there is an exhibit in your book that shows the FEMA flood zone boundaries. And as you might guess, it's right in the center of the site. So they will be moved into the center of the campground to winter over, if you will. But totally disconnected, winterized, and abandoned for the winter.
Okay, so with the exception of those units and the bathhouses and the various other buildings, the park would be empty from October 31st forward.
That's correct. With the exception of some maintenance activities, there will be no campers there. That's correct.
Okay. Let's go to the DART bus stop. It is inside the park. Right?
Yes. In fact, this exhibit that's up, Mr. Burton, is number 17 is an example of what that bus stop shelter would look like. They've given us some examples, which you saw in the supplemental book, and we haven't designed that yet, but that is the placeholder for that. This radius that you see here, again, this is a 30-foot wide access. The DART requirements require the developer, when they put this in, to have a separate lane. If there's anything going on here, people checking in, if there's any kind of issue with other vehicles, they need to be independent of that. They come in, they stop. I've forgotten exactly what the, you know, how often the stop is, but they stop, pick up, and discharge, and come right back out again and go right down to the next stop.
So all of the residents around the area are welcome to that bus stop?
It's a public bus stop.
And what about parking for that?
People driving their car to the bus? Well, there's parking there. We really haven't discussed that with DART. I don't know that that's a condition that exists, frankly. Most of the folks that would use this would walk to this site, I would guess. And there's another series of bus stops at various Potnets communities as you go up the road. So that's a good question. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Okay. Where is the next one? I mean, I like the bus stop. I just wonder where the closest one to it is.
To be perfectly honest, I don't know. There, if you look at we have the schedule in the book, and it references where the stops are in Potnets. Physically where they are, I can't answer that. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Okay, we got it.
The cafe, you said that it would be not open to the public or open to what? Tell me how that works.
The code is very clear that the features inside of a campground need to be, and the code uses the term primarily for the campers. So I guess if someone needed to stop at the general store, you know, they're not going to be thrown out. But it is primarily for the folks that are camping there. It is not. This is not a business set up for the community or the region. This is for the campers. And again, that's a that is an item that's described right in your code that we have to comply with. We can't have outside folks coming in and using the facilities here.
Okay. The buffer. Now I want to go. No, let me stay with the park. It's a weekly, daily, monthly. What is the plan with? What is your view?
The business plan again is the same business plan as they have in Castaways and Ocean City, and it is transient, meaning it's weekly. Now there are folks that spend several weeks. They come in the beginning of the season, the middle of the season, the end of the season, but they are not staying through. And I don't know if there are many daily campers, but there may be. You know, as Mr. Johnson said, if you're moving from place to place and you wanted to spend a couple of days, that's an option. Spending the entire season is not an option.
It's not an option. Okay. The booklet states that you would rather not put sidewalks in, and the alternative is golf carts. What if I don't want to drive a golf cart? Do I have a walking path somewhere?
You do. You do. As we said earlier, there the county requires a 30-foot wide, they don't call it a right-of-way, but it has that feel to it. It's a 30-foot wide set-aside space, and inside of that is a 20-foot paved way. Now, when you go camping, frankly, as Mr. Johnson said, most people go in there, they hook up, and that's it. They stay there. So there's not a lot of traffic on these streets except during periods at the beginning and end of the week. So you walk on the streets. One of the things we try to prevent and certainly encourage to do environmentally is to not add additional pavement. And I think that's the point we were trying to make in that comment, is that if you have a need, if you're not able to walk from place to place, there's an opportunity to get there with these electric golf carts. And they're very popular, I understand, in the Ocean City facility.
Okay, so you rent them in that facility as well?
Yes, sir.
And then just on the buffer that's right, that I really know is just Massey's Landing going out. Are you anticipating holding on to those trees that kind of buffer that edge?
You mean all of these?
No, over on actually Massey's Ditch going out.
Along here?
Right there, yeah.
Absolutely. We have to set back 50 feet from the water's edge. That's what this is representing right here.
So your plan would be to keep that intact as best you can.
Not only that, if you were to get up close to that photograph and look, you'll see that you see a lot of white sand. It's degraded. When Sandy came through, it just bashed it and took a lot of the plant material that was there, was meant to be there, took it away. And again, by virtue of our involvement with the permits to get these piers and things, the federal and state agencies are going to make us restore all that back the way it was and plant cordgrass and other natural plantings in there. So it'll be enhanced over and above what you see right now.
Are you anticipating any the need for riprap there?
Riprap is certainly the preferred alternative, and riprap may be appropriate in these areas where you have the high velocity in the deep water next to the what they call Massey's Ditch. As you go around where the beach area is and some of these interior areas, the agencies want to see vegetative means used and not all that stone. So it's really a kind of a case-by-case basis, and you view it from what's causing the erosion, how significant that is. I think there are no wake zones up here. I'm not a boater in that area. So, boat wake does create some problems, and there are features that you can put out in the water to kind of offset some of those impacts.
Okay. Thank you very much. All my questions.
All right, Richard. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Clark, most of my questions I've been clicking them off have been answered by the presentation. Did have a couple. The McCormick and Taylor letter does indicate a recommendation about a 5-foot bicycle lane should be striped. Is that something that the applicant has considered?
We don't have any choice. We would have to stripe, and again, that would be striped on the existing shoulder.
Understood.
That's there. It's a pretty generous shoulder that's there.
Another one is, I think, requesting a 5-foot sidewalk with a 5-foot buffer along the roadway.
We will not be putting that in. And the reason being that it would be a sidewalk to nowhere. So what we are doing, and is allowable through the agency, is you contribute. They have a per lineal foot cost of those, what they call multimodal paths. You contribute to that fund, and that fund someday is used to build a path somewhere where it makes more sense than it would here. The letter that's in Mr. Lank's file that he referenced, where we got a letter of no objection, what's called the LONO, they recognize that in there, that the applicant will be contributing to that multimodal path fund. In this particular case, that path would require removing trees on both sides of the road. So aside from the fact that the path goes nowhere other than at the beginning and end of our property, it would remove all those trees, Mr. Smith. So I think DLDOT saw the wisdom in accepting our cash contribution.
So that sidewalk wouldn't be seen as an asset to someone walking down to the bus stop at the marina area?
Again, you have an 8-foot wide shoulder, and that's pretty generous in terms of what we see in Sussex County for pedestrians to share that with the bicyclists. The bicycle lane is a 5-foot wide lane, so there's, in my opinion, ample room for both.
Are there going to be guest parking spaces provided in the site plan?
There are. I referred earlier in my presentation to the parking spaces that are lined up along the 50-foot buffer next to Long Neck Road. All of those interior parking spaces that you see at the gateway there are parking spaces for guests.
Will there be any marking as to giving the public notification of where the boundaries of the wetlands are and that they may be an environmentally sensitive area and public should not?
What's been suggested in our meetings with the agencies is that we use split rail fences. Now, that, to be honest, we've not committed to the agencies yet, and if you have a preference in that, Mr. Smith, we'd be glad to have you make that a condition. But signs in a campground situation may not be enough. I think you might need a more physical barrier.
That's all the questions I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right, Mr. Clark. Mr. Ross.
Mr. Fouquet. If the public gets up after we get done questioning you and they object to your project with support of objective facts, I think you called it earlier in your presentation, that somehow undermine your argument and support, and subsequently the commission recommend denial of your project, in your legal opinion, would that decision be arbitrary or capricious?
I don't think Mr. Fouquet needs to answer that. I mean, that's something that it would be based on the record if we were on appeal.
What I was referring to is because I do view traffic as the main issue here, not to in any way minimize any other issues, but I do view traffic as a main issue in the roadways. And obviously I know that on the prior application that the gentleman heard, on the Love Creek situation, I know that was delayed to get an updated traffic study, although I think in that case there hadn't been a traffic study, but in any event, I knew there was some rumblings that we had a 2005 traffic impact study and that it would be accused of being stale, and I just wanted to state that there was no basis to that type of opinion, and I've already stated the reasons why I felt that that had a factual basis, and I was referring to more things of that nature. Obviously, ultimately, I can determine what I think the true facts are, but it doesn't matter what I determine. It matters what you determine the true facts are, although we all should arrive at the same conclusion if we're all viewing things in a reasonable manner. So, but, yeah, the decision should be based on that, and it obviously if a decision isn't based on the facts, it is arbitrary, whatever you know that might be.
Well, the point I'm trying to make, without objection from counsel, is that basically our decision is not based on popularity. That objections or support of the application have to be based on legality and statement of facts, not just feelings of opposition or feelings in support. And that brings me to my first substantive question.
The dwelling, the RV campsites are supposed to be 400 feet from any existing residential dwelling. Can you explain why this complies to that requirement?
Yes. And I'm a lawyer, so I'm going to tell you the legal answer. Okay? A manufactured home, according to the definition in the Sussex County Zoning Ordinance, is not a dwelling.
Ladies and gentlemen, excuse me. As I stated at the outset of the public hearing, we're not going to allow any disruptive behavior during the hearing. And I actually, rather than have Mr. Fuqua answer that, you know, it's one that I was looking at when we were looking at the project as a whole. Just for the benefit of the commission and the public and the applicant, as the commission recalls from other application, there's a requirement that the campsite areas shall be at least 400 feet from any existing dwelling of property of other ownership, et cetera. So what you need to do is look at the definition of a dwelling. And when you turn to the definitions of that are set forth in the zoning code, it says, bear with me, a dwelling is a building or a portion thereof containing cooking and housekeeping facilities designed or used exclusively for residential occupancy, but not including manufactured homes, hotels, motels, motor lodges, boarding or lodging houses, tourist courts, or tourist homes. So that requirement that I referred to in the beginning of my remarks with regard to campgrounds or RV parks that says that you have to have 400 feet from any existing dwelling, a dwelling does not include a manufactured home by definition in the code.
Yeah, and Mr. Ross, we'd certainly, as I said, we certainly recognize that this is a legal definition for purposes of the zoning ordinance. We certainly recognize that a manufactured home is someone's home, someone's dwelling, but for legal purposes of the zoning ordinance, that requirement does not apply to manufactured homes.
Sort of a practical definition versus what the code's definition is. Yeah, that's right.
When I first asked Mr. Robinson this, I questioned that deeply, but I understand also what's in the ordinance, and I can't question that. Regarding the RVs, we've had comments in the past, and some are on record in the letters that I read prior to the meeting that were submitted, about the size of the RVs and their impact on traffic. I just want to make sure that are all the RVs of legal size and weight?
Yes, I'm sure as you know, there's federal regulations regarding the size of an RV. They can't be manufactured greater than that. And the only thing I would state is, you know, RVs travel on Route 13 and Route 1. They travel on back roads. They travel throughout our national parks. They travel everywhere. This road is no different than any other road. And I think as Mr. Ryman stated, this is a connector, a major collector road, which is adequate width with shoulders. And certainly these vehicles can travel up and down that road just as they can any other road, and really are no different than buses or trucks or any other vehicles that travel this road already. Also, I would add that there's the boats on trailers that go down this road to go to the boat launch, so it's nothing unusual.
Mr. Ryman? In the book, you're using standards and equations from the Institute of Transportation's Engineers. You called it ITE. Is this the holy grail of establishing traffic counts?
That is what DLDOT uses to establish the
trip. Are there other standards that could be used?
That is what DLDOT's first source is. If the data exists in that source, that is what they use. If there wasn't data, then they could look at other studies for a particular use. But in this case, data does exist for this particular use, so that is what they use. Okay.
Do you know off the top of your head other institutions or entities that might be able to supply data such as this or use your TIS for interpretation?
We use ITE all the time.
Exclusively?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Clark, and then I'm done. Mr. Clark, the emergency evacuation in your book is basically dependent on the Sussex County Emergency Director to issue the different phases of evacuation notices, phase one, phase two, et cetera. But as already been noted, this particular site is just south of an area that is an early warning device for flooding. It's flood prone. So is there a way that are you going to be communicating with the county emergency director or someone there to advance the evacuation of this site, understanding that this often floods prior to an evacuation, mandatory evacuation notice?
Well, the plan that you're referring to in our application is a draft, of course. In fact, it's a draft that's been generated using the actual plan that is used in Ocean City. The Sussex County website, if you're familiar with it, is very well done. And certainly that's available to the folks who are managing the park. I think the testimony earlier was curious in that these particular vehicles need to get out of harm's way for wind events before the rest of us. And, if there is a storm event where the road is, reaching a point where it may flood, then that's a judgment call that'll be made by management. I guess maybe they'll rely on some recommendations from the folks, the emergency personnel in that area. But that really has not been thought out beyond what you see there as a draft, Mr. Ross.
Do you know if the county emergency director gives localized advice, such as for Oak Orchard, Long Neck, those areas that flood are prone to flooding in a storm event?
I do not. I do not know the answer to that. I would expect that kind of advice may come from the fire company that's right there in Long Neck, that they'd be more familiar with their local situation.
Yeah, that's all, Mr. Chairman.
All right, sir. Mr. Lank?
All my questions have been answered. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Abbott?
No questions.
Counsel?
All my questions have been answered for now, too. Thanks.
All right, then. Gentlemen, we thank you. Ask you to remain nearby, if you would, and this time we will ask if there is anyone who would like to speak in favor of change of zone number 1729 and or conditional use number 1963, Ida C. Fawcett, Fawcett Heirs, LLC, and Massey's Landing Park, Incorporated. Okay, no one in favor to speak. Very good. Is there anyone here that would like to speak in opposition? Are there any attorneys representing groups this evening? We have one. Our rules say that we allow attorneys representing groups to go first. Also would like to ask, is there anyone else that has an audiovisual presentation? I know we have one and two this evening. Are you teed up at this time?
No.
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a 5-minute recess. Well, I would want to let you get teed up, and then we're going to have our attorney present, and then we will have you present, and then probably put somebody between you and the next one so he can be getting ready to just kind of try to expedite matters. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to recess for exactly 5 minutes. And at the end of 5 minutes, we're going to start. And, ma'am, I expect you to be up here and speaking in 5 minutes.